The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
It's called PAD, peripheral arterial disease, and if you've got chronic leg pain, it may be time to get tested. Learn more at demanddebora.org. Call 609-621-2080 to schedule a screening.
The Major League Baseball draft begins on June 12th. It is a hugely important event for every team and the primary way to bring talent into your system. Remember the glory days and the Phillies World Series Championship of 2008? Well, Ryan Howard, Chase Utley, Jimmy Rollins, Cole Hamels, and Ryan Madsen, all huge reasons that the Phillies won that World Series, first entered the organization through the draft. For the Phillies scouting staff, the draft is not really a three-day event. Preparation for the 2017 draft started years ago when scouts first started peeking in on young talent and began charting its progress leading up to when it becomes draft eligible. Scouts are baseball's unsung heroes, the guys that spend hundreds of nights a year on the road trying to uncover the next big star. With the draft arriving, let's learn a little bit more about the life of a scout and all the preparation that goes into the draft from Eric Valent. He oversees the talent-rich Southeast region for the Phillies scouting staff. Well, here we are. We're in the month of June now, and we're getting to be about 10 days away from the annual first-year player draft, and it's always an exciting time, and I thought it would be a perfect guest would be a member of the Phillies scouting staff, and I have one of the best in Eric Valent, former Phillies player, former Met, former Cincinnati Red, coached in the Phillies system and a member of their scouting staff since 2009. Eric, you have a day off. It's weird leading up to the draft. You guys are all over the place.
Yeah, we'll go into Philly on Monday. We'll start draft meetings June 5th. So this is a little bit of a lull week. There's still a few high school games going on, but for the most part, it's just regroup, start to get organized, talk to my area scouts that I help, that I work with and supervise. You have NCAA regionals this weekend that we'll have area scouts at. But for the most part, for cross-checkers like myself, it's kind of just to look at your region, kind of eyeball guys in the top 10 rounds, maybe guys third day. So when we go in there, we can have some type of template to start with.
Mm-hmm. And you played right up until, I think, what, 2007? I think you were in Japan that year. And a member of the Phillies minor league coaching staff. What drew you to become, you know, a scout?
Yeah, I think it was... I wish I played 10 years in the big leagues and was, you know, coaching youth ball or something like that, but that didn't happen. But no, baseball's been a part of my life ever since I was playing in scout ball leagues when I was in eighth grade. I had an older brother that played scout ball in Southern California, so I'd go to the games, and before you know it, I'm out there playing outfield. I'm in eighth grade playing against junior college kids. So, you know, I was always a baseball rat, knew I was going to be in the game my whole life. So as my playing career was coming, when I was getting towards 30, even when I was 21, when I signed, I knew I was going to play in the big leagues, and it was going to be up to me to what type of player I was going to become and how long I was going to stay there. So I always told myself, by the time I'm 30, if I'm not kind of in the major league, sign a major league contract, it's going to be time to, you know, bridge that towards my next phase. So I got to that point in 2006. I went to Japan, didn't play that well, and I wanted to play one more year in AAA in 2007. And I live outside of Philly. I live here in Berks County in Wyomissing. So I wanted to play, you know, either play in Scranton, Norfolk, somewhere close to home, because I had a young son and one coming on my way, my other one at the time. So a AAA job kind of didn't come to fruition. So I said, you know what, that's it. I kind of took that summer off. I contacted Steve Novarita, and, you know, I've had a lot of great relationships here from a player, and I was lucky enough to come back, and I coached. I always wanted to get into scouting, but there was no scouting opportunity up in the Northeast at the time. So I coached with us in 08. And then Gene Shaw, who was the area supervisor who had been scouting for a few years, he took over the East Coast to supervise. And then I came in and took over the area starting in 2009, did the Northeast region. So that's kind of how I got started. And before you know it, 9 years later, scouting, you just see they kind of start running together.
Now, you started as an area scout, and I've always believed, and everyone believes, that like the unsung heroes of the game. I mean, the area scout, you know, when the high school season starts, I shouldn't even, you're keeping a book on a kid 2 and 3 years before a draft. You see a kid catch your eye. But, you know, as you're leading up to the draft, high school season starts, sometimes it's snowing, raining, it's cold in the Northeast. But you're in your car driving 3 hours here, 4 hours there, 5 hours here to see a kid. What is the life of an area scout like? What is a typical day for an area scout?
Yeah, so we definitely drive. Going back to myself, when I did the Northeast, like you said, you're going to battle the weather constantly. So we kind of start out, all the colleges, Division I weekends started usually around mid-February. Division IIs would start maybe a weekend before that. So a lot of times I'd go down in a drive down to North Carolina that first weekend of February, try to catch Kutztown or Mercyhurst playing at a Division II in North Carolina, drive back home, be at home for a few days, and then I'd make a long trip down to Florida for about 3 weeks, and that's where a lot of your D1s, your UConn's, your Boston College, they start playing teams down there and stay for 10 days. So this was 8 or 9 years ago. So I kind of stay down there for 3 weeks and then kind of work your way back up, and then hopefully the weather would be good towards the middle, late March, and the high school, you can get some high school scrimmages in before the season starts. So that way, at least, it's almost not a real game, but it's a game where they're playing scrimmages where you can at least fire in that first report for the spring, because being a Northeast scout, it's not like California, Florida, Texas. You can see these guys all the time. So when you're doing the Northeast, you got to come in, and especially your top guys, and you've seen them over the summer. They have background on them, but you got to make that call right when you see them when the season opens up, just so the supervisor and stuff know that, hey, they got an alert. They can keep that in their back pocket so they know they got to come up and see them at some point. But, yeah, it's a lot of driving. I used to commute Boston here, especially when my kids were small. I didn't mind driving. For me, it's finding that balance with your family life and scouting. So I'd wake up at 8 in the morning, you know, get on the road at 8, be in Boston by 1, watch the high school game from 3 o'clock to 7 o'clock, be home by midnight, and that way I'm there to help for breakfast. Sure. Or do whatever in the morning. So commute Pittsburgh sometimes, and but yeah, you're in your car a lot, but you didn't mind it. It's part of the job. You're making phone calls, and especially myself as a regional guy, I know, you know, being an area scout, it's a lonely job at times, and it's a tough job. I mean, you're just giving your opinion. You're even the best guys that you see, sometimes you're like, God, is he gonna do it? I'm not sure. I mean, you're constantly, a lot of these, you're second guessing yourself. So you think about that on the best guys. As you get further away from those guys, it's even tougher. So for the most part, you're just kind of identifying tools, identifying if the kid, as much makeup as you can. I mean, it's tough to get too deep into makeup when these kids are especially the high school kids, they're almost in a little cocoon. You know, the best players who we should be looking at, the high school kids to sign, are hitting 450, 500. They're never having a bad day. They're kings on campus. So even if they do an 0-for-4, they go from 480 to 460. So it's never in a realm of failure. So until they get out to the minor leagues where they're going to have their 1-for-20 with 15 strikeouts or their 4 bad starts in a row as a pitcher, that's when you know where you're at, your baseline of the kid's makeup. So, yeah, it's an interesting job. It's fun. I love my relationships with the area guys. I mean, especially being a supervisor now, that's number one for me, is just knowing that it's our little team, that I'm always talking to them, especially in the springtime leading up to the draft.
Now, you graduated from your role as Northeast area scout, where you're driving all over identifying kids, and now you're the Southeast supervisor.
Yeah.
So how big is your staff of area scouts in the Southeast?
So what we have 4 regional supervisors like myself, and I cover Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and the Panhandle, and Mike Stauffer's our area supervisor for that. So I supervise with Mike. And then we have Alan Marr, who covers pretty much North Florida down to like Fort Myers and across. And then we have Luis Rafon, who does South Florida and Puerto Rico. And then Alex Agostino, since I live up in Pennsylvania, I have some area up here as well. Mm-hmm. He covers New York, New England states, and Eastern Canada. And then I also see players outside of my region as well. But for the most part, that's my focus, is working with those 4 guys, seeing their best players, kind of getting their gut feel guys, and just seeing, getting as deep on their list as I can, and just making sure we're seeing the best players in our region.
When do you start keeping a book on a kid?
the area supervisors.
Or even an area guy.
So yeah, yeah.
Well, back when you were an area guy, there's a kid that, you know, and you live in the Reading area, there's a kid you maybe heard about. Mm-hmm. When do you actually start, you know, keeping a book on him, charting his progress? Because, you know, one day he's going to become draft eligible.
So I'll start it like this. So say the draft year starts in February. Boom. From the past. Actually, no, let's start it from after the draft. It's easier that way. Okay, mm-hmm. So boom, the draft's going to end. We just saw so many high school kids for this year that we're going to see. Maybe as we're seeing those players, you're running across high school kids from other teams when you're watching the game that might be juniors or sophomores.
That's a great point. I think that's how they discovered J.P. Crawford. They were watching Shane Watson.
Exactly.
Were on the same team.
Yep.
A year apart. I remember, you know, way back when.
Milton Bradley and Chase Utley on the same high school team by year apart.
So that, yeah, that and also Zach Greinke was a pitcher shortstop in the Orlando area.
Yeah.
And he had a teammate named Michael Taylor, outfielder,
yeah,
who ended up being drafted by the Phillies and, you know, I think made it to AAA with
exactly,
the Phillies. So,
yeah.
I mean, you're out there. You always have your eyes wide open to every kid on that field, correct?
Correct. Yeah, you're definitely zoning in on the guy you're there to see, because that's the most important to this current draft. And then, of course, as the other guys are showing up, you jot some notes down. Maybe you have enough to start the report in the computer. So you do it that way. And then so we have the draft. And then, boom, right after the draft, we start a lot of the summer coverage stuff for the high school kids. There's different showcases down there. There's the Perfect Game National down in Florida. There's the Tournament of Stars in North Carolina, where a lot of the best players across the whole country are coming into one place.
So once that draft hits, we're going to have the draft the second week of June coming up here. I mean, it's done, and you are on to the next class.
Literally, it's like, you know, you get the guy signed, and you're, boom, it's done. Okay, let's move it on to the next crop.
It never ends.
Yeah, so you go to Cape Cod. Cape Cod covers the different collegiate leagues. I mean, there's so much now, and there's so many opportunities where these kids to play baseball compared to even when I was in college. So there's so much stuff to see and for an area scout and for scouts like myself, so to kind of just start your list for the next year. And especially with technology now, there's, you know, so much social media out there and things get out there. So you're even getting names that way, and you're going just to, it's almost like a bird dog lead where you're going just to see the guy, see what he's about. So for the most part, it's hard to find that diamond in the rough now with technology and how it connects everybody, especially if you're a tremendous player. It's not going to be a secret.
How frustrating is it to be an area guy and drive 4 hours and get there? And you know within one inning this kid can't play.
Yeah, that's not that's just part of the job. That happens a lot, and that's what you're there to do. You go to see the players. Not all player is going to be a great prospect. But hey, what if you go there and he's not the guy, but you see someone that's 2 years younger, or maybe there's a guy that wasn't known about. So you kind of look at it that way, and that's just part of the job.
And how many nights per year are you on the road?
I'd say roughly anywhere around 140 or so. 130,
wow.
Yeah.
I mean, life on the road. I spend quite a bit of time on the road.
Exactly.
Any horror stories?
No, especially in the spring when you're traveling. So, I mean, that's the bulk of my travel, February probably through May leading up to the draft. So, you know, it's forgetting sometimes where you park coming back from a long road trip at the Philly airport, or, you know, making sure you text yourself the letter at the long-term parking. You know, going from, you know, say different hotel 4 nights in a row, you're coming back to the hotel and you're going on the second floor and realizing I'm on the fifth floor in this hotel. So, yeah, stuff like that.
Have you ever tried your room key in the wrong room?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Done that all the time. So I just learned to kind of, especially when I'm parking, always text myself where I parked.
That's a good idea.
Keep the book jacket of the hotel key so I know what room number I'm in.
I love the story.
Little stuff like that.
Jim Fregosi Jr. Mm-hmm. was on your staff with the Phillies for a long time. Now he's with Kansas City. And he told me a story once that, you know, he parked his car at LAX and went off on a month-long scouting trip right before the draft.
Yeah.
And then he flew home, but he flew home to the Ontario airport, and he's wandering around the airport looking for his car. He can't find it, so he called the police and said, "My car has been stolen." Well, it turned out he had it at an airport like 50 miles away.
Yeah, there's tons of stuff like that, and it seems like every year, too, the last couple of years, I'm going down in my scout down in the southeast. I'll be in Mississippi, and it seems like I have, say, a 4:45 flight out of Jackson, and I'm getting back to my hotel from a game at getting back there at midnight, and you're so scared to go to sleep that you get back to the room, shower up, and there's a Waffle House right near the airport, and I'm and I'm just eating there at 1:30 in the morning, and then just going to the airport and just sitting in the lobby before I gotta, you know, hop on, either go home or go into the next game. So that's kind of been a reunion for me in a sense the last couple of years.
The Waffle House, I think, probably a scout's best friend.
Oh, yeah, certain times.
Especially Southeast.
Yeah.
Now, as the overseer of the Southeast region for the Philly Scouting Department, wow, you talk about a fertile area.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, with the SEC, is probably the best amateur league in the world, would you say?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, you got the SEC, the Pac-12, the ACC, and probably like the Big 12, yeah.
And you got, hey, you got Aaron Nola out of there in 2014. Mm-hmm. How many times a kid like that did the Phillies staff, put it this way, when did the Phillies staff start keeping a book on a guy like Aaron Nola?
Okay, yeah.
How many times did they see Aaron Nola?
So Mike Stauffer was area supervisor then. He had the area even when Aaron was in high school in Baton Rouge. So we saw him in high school, but he was going to LSU. His older brother was there. He wasn't going to be quite a first-round pick out of high school just because there were so many other talented players that you felt comfortable before him.
But you had a lot of intelligence.
Exactly. He always threw a ton of strikes. He was a mean competitor. So Mike saw him starting in high school. And then as you're seeing guys at the Kevin Gossman say at that time when he was a junior, or excuse me, he might have been a junior when Aaron was a freshman, maybe or they had a position player on the team, so you're seeing Aaron pitch as a freshman. He pitched for Team USA shortly at one time, but
so before that draft, what would you, when you guys?
Oh, we have so many reports. Yeah. I would think, oh my gosh, I think I saw him at least three times. Mike, our area supervisor, probably at least five or six times. You know, Ruben saw him at that time, all the different cross-checkers, the special assistants. So
you've seen, like, probably his junior year, his draft year, every one of his starts.
Oh, yeah.
Practices.
A ton.
Fall workouts.
And guys like that, you're still doing your work, but they're the easy ones. You know, he's in the best conference. He's one of the best pitchers. If you go back and look at history, there's a very, very good chance that he's going to pitch in the big leagues. How good he's going to be? Is he going to be a three starter, a two starter? Aaron will dictate that as he's there. Mm-hmm. So, but you knew with what he was doing, he's going to pitch in the major leagues. And after that, it's up to the player to see how good he's going to be.
Mm-hmm. I think scouting baseball might be, I mean, it's definitely, it's not scientific.
No,
there's a
correct.
Lot of gut feel in it. There's a lot more analytics now in it, but I would think it's really incredibly hard, especially to judge hitters and pitchers, but there's a monumental equipment change in the game of baseball from an amateur to a professional. It's called the aluminum bat and the wood bat. What type of a challenge does that present you when you're scouting a hitter?
You know, a lot of the best high school kids we're zoned in on, they're swinging wood all summer, so we see with a lot of the wood bats. So I don't know so much that as it is when these, you know, say a high school kid or even a college kid, you go out and sign professionally, they're used to only playing, as a high school kid, say you're playing two games a week, college you're playing four games, but it's at you every day for 5 months. So that's what it's like more so than probably say the bat is. You have to go grind it out every single day. You're getting four or five at bats, especially if you're a prospect, you're going to play 6 days a week. Whether you go 0 for 4 and then accumulates to another 0 for 4, you're going to get back in there and compete. So that's the main thing. It's just competing every day. You're facing even better pitching. Each level you move up, it gets tougher and tougher. So it's you're finding yourself as a hitter. It's fine knowing what your strengths and weaknesses are. And even as a college and high school player, you know what they are. Mm-hmm. And as you get into professional baseball, the more reps you take, some adjustments you're going to make or you adapt, maybe what once was a weakness is going to become a strength, or you're changing your approach. So it's all those little things where the hitter has to really be, we have as many resources as we can for them. But in the end, you have to be your best coach, because from high school, then you're switching teams, you go to college, you switch levels in the minor leagues, you go to the big leagues, coaches change teams. Coaches change all the time, so you have to be your best coach in order to compete and survive at the major league level.
Mm-hmm. If you had a kid that wanted to be a pro ball player, would you advise him to take BP with a lot of wood? Because it is a different feel. You have to really get through the ball.
Yeah, you definitely have less of a sweet spot. Yeah, what I advise them is once they have, make sure they're using similar weight of their bat. Mm-hmm. Just where you don't want to develop any bad habits. And definitely quality over quantity. You want to make, it's almost like, would you rather take 150 mindless swings or 25 where you're zoned in and focused?
Really,
so that's kind of what you want to be.
How big of a challenge is it for, and I think it is for a lot of scouting departments, the quote-unquote, the classic ball player, you know, the heady kid who can do a lot of things well, you know. I think of a Scott Kingery.
Yeah.
Against the kid with unbelievable off the charts tools, athletic ability, can run, can throw, just drips with tools.
Yeah.
How do you kind of balance all of that in your mind when you're scouting a kid, tools versus that classic ball player? Because the tools guy, if he clicks, you're going to get Andre Dawson.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think with, let's say a guy like Kingery, even like a guy like Pedroia, say that was coming out. These guys, we say, okay, they're not tooled out, this and that, but Kingery, he could run. Maybe Scott wasn't tooled out in the sense of how much power he was going to have when he's, you know, he's hitting a ton of home runs right now. But for the most part, is these guys have tremendous hand-eye coordination, and baseball is such a skilled sport where the history of the game shows you that you don't have to be a tremendous athlete to play, to be a good baseball player. You have to have tremendous hand-eye coordination. You got to have great awareness on the field, a student of the game as far as knowing what the pitcher's going to do to you. What does he have that day? Is he throwing it for a strike? There's so many different aspects that you can pick up to minimize to give yourself a better chance, because it is so hard to hit. We know, I mean, it's amazing how much failure there is. So there's so many things that you can pick up in order to become successful rather than having all the greatest tools in the world.
What do you prioritize? Tools or?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You want guys that, you know, when you go to the game, you can kind of tell who the best players are in the field. So, yeah, you want guys that can run. You want guys that have power, of course. You want guys that can continually hit the ball hard and put the ball in play, that can be the plus defenders. So it's a whole mixture of things. And, of course, so say you have a tooled-out guy, plus runner, he can throw. BP, he's got raw power. Then the game starts, and it's a total different swing. He's swinging and missing. So your appetite as far as, gosh, dang, do I think he's ever going to get to what I think he's going to be, rather than a guy, you know what, this guy may not be quite as good, but he's going to be a good, he's going to be a big league player. And he might even end up being better than what I thought. So that's kind of the balance. But with the toolsy guy, what you're saying, of course, if it's tools and there's feel with the plate, I mean, he's going to go in the first five picks of the country. But after that, yeah, you're just looking for ball players. And when you're kind of comparing them, you kind of see maybe that draft has a lot of those guys. Maybe it has a lot of baseball player types, or maybe it has some of those projections, or our minor league system is very strong. We have a chance to, we want to take a risk on something at that time. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that come into play.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, tell us a little bit about what this draft looks like that's going to happen in a couple weeks. Some years it's a strong high school draft. Some years it's a strong college draft. Some years it's loaded with pitchers. Mm-hmm. Some years it's loaded with hitters. What does this one kind of shape up as?
Yeah, I haven't seen all the best players across the country, but there's some high school some college position players have kind of separated themselves at the top. There seems to be a decent amount of college pitching, maybe not necessarily like a ton of front end guys, but guys that you could feel that are going to be starters at some point.
I mean, when you're scouting a pitcher,
yeah,
let's say you're scouting a college pitcher, mm-hmm. what are you looking for?
Well, especially like, say, an SEC conference. I mean, these guys, you have 3 years of history as far as if they've made starts coming in as a freshman. Like, for example, a guy like Aaron Nola, to come in as a freshman and make starts and compete in that environment down in Baton Rouge, where these guys are like rock stars now. I mean, it's a lot of pressure. So when you get a kid as a freshman coming in and making 12 starts and being a lock in a rotation, I mean, that shows you a lot about what type of person he is, what type of competitor he can handle pressures. So that goes a long way.
So you're scouting the person as well as the player.
Oh yeah, most definitely. You've done that. You've been in this game a long time. It's so hard to manage that grind. I was there. It's such a mind battle, especially you got great players, a small percentage of great players in the major leagues. And then you have those marginal to average guys where if you can't handle that grind and you're too hard on yourself, or you have a lot of peaks and valleys, you're not going to last that long. So it's about managing that day to day and being able to be consistent and compete.
Do you scout a promising high school pitcher differently than you would scout a promising college pitcher in terms of what you're looking for?
Yeah. So, you're definitely high school pitching. You're looking at, you know, their body, going to add weight, how their arm works. Can they have feel for the breaking ball? Are they somewhat around a zone throwing strikes?
Because they're going to
keep getting better. Yeah, exactly. Keep getting better. You figure, you know, you're seeing a 17, 18 year old kid, you know, you got to give him 3 years. You got to almost look at it as, okay, his freshman years. Can I forecast this guy pitching a rotation in the SEC? Okay. By his next year getting better. And then, you know, professional level where he's going to get all development. It's not going to be about winning. It's going to be about, okay, throwing your changeup until you feel comfortable with it, locating the fastball down and away, getting on your routine, knowing what you got to do, reading hitter swings. So that's, I think that they speed. That's a much more sped up process for the high school kid in professional baseball, I would say, rather than college, where they're learning. There's great coaches in college. A lot of best players in the major leagues come from college.
It must be tough to scout a high school kid just because it's there's more projection involved, where a college kid, you know, he's faced good competition. You can kind of almost envision a little more clearly a finished product.
Correct. Yeah, and you want those. I mean, but, you know, there's some of the best high school kids. Say for a Cole Hamels, he was almost like a college kid. He was up to 94. He had a great changeup. He spun the breaking ball. He was he threw strikes. He was much more savvy than a mm-hmm. high school kid. So mm-hmm. that's kind of, especially when you're getting into the first round, any high school guy like that, what you're taking, they're pretty polished kids. They're baseball players, and they have tools and talent.
How much fun is it to find a kid like in the 20th round or something?
Oh, yeah, especially for the area guys. I mean, it's awesome because, you know, as far as the first three rounds or so, we have so many people seeing players that, and so much of that is out of, say, the area scout's control to a certain extent, because he's, okay, I like this guy in the second round, but then it's other guys that are seeing players from all over the country kind of stacking them up against each other. And plus all the other teams, for the most part, like those guys too.
Sure.
So, I mean, so it's definitely, when you get to that third day, it's guys that, that you know, just gut field guys, even if they're a lot, you know, they're not going to have as much current status as prospect as the ones you take early, but hey, a guy might be in a better hitter than you thought. Maybe he's got a better work ethic than you thought. Maybe his mind works where he can do it every day, and he gets better, or something clicks, or a pitching coach unlocks something. So yeah, so that's it's definitely gratifying. I would say more so for the guy late than early, especially mm-hmm. for the area supervisor. Yeah.
Hey, tell me about the pressure that when you're, especially these days, when you're a kid who's got the ability and everybody knows you're going to be drafted mm-hmm. high, and I would imagine that. That kid, he's got to go out there and play well, but he must be putting a lot of pressure on himself. And nobody better to talk about it than you. I mean, you yeah. were a high pick by the Phillies out of a baseball powerhouse, mm-hmm. UCLA, teammate of Chase Utley.
But yeah.
What goes through a young college kid or even a high school kid's mind when, because you were drafted out of high school as well.
Yeah, correct, yeah.
So in the back of your mind, this has to be a kind of a pressure-packed time for a player.
Yeah, it is and it's not. I mean, especially these guys that are high school kids that are getting scouted by professional guys their senior year in the summer. They know they're good, and this is what they want to do. Whether they end up in college or sign professionally, they're kind of used to that spotlight. And then it just goes down to the kid as far as at that time, is he a relaxed kid? How much pressure does he put on himself? And so that's a good thing to pick up on a scout's too, is, hey, does it bother him, the attention? You know, maybe that's something he's going to have to work through as he gets closer to the big leagues and the minor league baseball. But for the most part, these guys are seen so much. I mean, we have different events where they're heavily scouted, and these guys, it's what they want to do. It's what's expected. So there might be a little bit of nervousness as the season starts, as there is probably for some big leaguers when the season starts. You want to get off to a good start, so you're not trying to play catch up all year mm-hmm. for the most part. But
one of the bigger challenges for you guys is getting to know the person, the competitor. Is he a good kid? Is he going to drive us nuts?
Yeah.
Is he going to behave? Is he going to be, you know, goal-centered? And, you know, I remember talking, you got to get to know the kid and the family. And, you know, I remember way back when the Phillies were on Scott Rolen, when mm-hmm. he was a high school player in Indiana. And, you know, he had a basketball scholarship to Georgia. And he wanted to play basketball at Kentucky. I think he could have gone there as a walk-on. But, and I remember writing about this. The area scout, Scott Turka, at the time, mm-hmm. a lot of people didn't think Rolen would sign. But Scott Turka went to every one of his games, and he listened to people who knew him. He mm-hmm. talked to the parents and got the feel that if we take this kid in the right spot, I think we can get him signed. And that's just getting to know him as a person. What is the kind of the craziest thing you've ever done to get to know a kid as a person? I mean, do you go watch him play high school basketball?
Oh, sure, yeah. I remember my first year scouting. It's funny you say that. I got hired in November of 2000. I switched over in 2008 to the scouting side. So I kind of missed the summer stuff to see a lot of the high school kids. And mm-hmm. that was Mike Trout was going to be, he was eligible for the draft in 2009, my first year, which we didn't pick and weren't going to be picking until 75 that year. So really had no chance to get him at all.
I remember talking to Gene Shaw, one of the Philly scouts, the year Mike Trout was in mm-hmm. the draft. And I was working on a draft story, and And as I was finishing the interview, he said, I'm getting in my car and I'm going over to Millville to watch Mike Trout. Of course, we have no chance at him because we don't pick that high, but I want to go see him one more time.
Yeah, exactly. So that summer, that fall winter, Mike played basketball. So I kind of just went to a game one day just to kind of meet his parents, Mike and Jeff and Debbie, sat with them and watched Mike in the stands, got something to eat. So, yeah, our scouts are always doing stuff like that, different sports, maybe going to their home, talking to the coaches. And we can do all that, there's so many variables and challenges that are going to come across a player as he signs, and different things change in a kid's life from when he's 17 to maybe when he's 23. Then maybe he gets married, or maybe he has some stuff's going on at home, or maybe faces some personal challenges. Or there's so many variables, but for the most part, you try to do as much as you can and feel comfortable what type of player he is. Hey, is he good grades? Does he show up for practice? Is he a good teammate? And then when you get to the college guys, these guys at big schools, these college coaches are making a lot of money and running it. They have to be paid to win. So if you got a college guy that's been on the team for 3 years, he's getting good grades, hasn't been suspended, you feel pretty good. But as far as forecasting how they're going to be, there's such a long way away. And you can be prepared for as much as you think, but until you just get into it, you don't know how it's going to be.
Is there a lot of gamesmanship between scouts from different organizations? Like, are you standing behind a backstop on a cold day as an area guy with your gun out looking at a kid? And do you ever say, I don't really like him, because you don't want to tip off the other guy, but you really do like him?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Even, everyone, you have friends that are with different teams, and of course. Yeah. But especially if you like somebody, you may just see, he's pretty good. Or, we kind of like him. Or, so-and-so doesn't like him. We have no chance at him or something. So, you try to do that, make those type of rumors or whatnot, but
that's what the Phillies did with,
and everybody does, yeah,
with Cole Hamels. He was coming off that, he had a broken arm as a sophomore, and they took him slow as a junior, and everybody had health concerns, and the Phillies were like, we're very worried about about his health. So people, other teams, the Phillies aren't on Cole Hamels. Well, they were.
Exactly.
So I think you got to do that. I love that creativity. Tell me, you've seen, how many games a year you see?
I don't know. Almost every single day in the spring. They definitely get home and see the family. But a ton. I don't even know. Hundreds. So
what's the most exciting amateur draft prospect you ever laid your eyes on?
Well, I would say, Mike was a kid that
Mike Trout.
Yeah, he definitely stood out, and I missed him all that summer. But as the spring went on, I kept going to watch him. He was just so physically strong and fast, and it just got down. I just remember watching him run down the line one time. It was almost like a fullback, running down to first base. And I remember, I think in one of my reports, I might have put like a ball of energy running down to first base. It was just so he was so physical. And especially when it gets to the big leagues when he's 19 years old, they're going to be freaks like that. So he definitely was a kid that stood out as far as those physical aspects of his tool.
Surprised he lasted to 20, whatever it was, 23.
Yeah, especially being a Northeast guy. You go back to the thing as a high school kid, right-handed hitting high school out. At a time there were some proven college players and whatnot. So it's easy definitely to look in hindsight of, how did these teams pass on them, this and that. But, that happens. You can talk about Ryan Howard in the fifth round, Paul Goldschmidt in the eighth round. There's things like that all throughout the history of the draft. So it's easy to second guess. But luckily, we weren't picking 75 that year, but definitely was a tremendous, tremendous prospect.
Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier, you played at UCLA with Chase Utley.
Yeah.
And you were a junior when he was a freshman?
Yeah, junior was.
What was it like to play with him? And what would have been your scouting report? You're a junior at UCLA. Put a scouting report on freshman Chase Utley.
Oh, Chase Utley, thin, wiry, great extension. If you would have saw his swing, it was such a pretty stroke, especially when he was younger. And then you wouldn't say as his career went on in Philly, it was necessarily a pretty stroke. It was short. It was so
ferocious.
Short. It wasn't like that graceful Will Clark. But he, at one time, he really did have just tremendous extension on the ball. Yeah, he did. I specifically remember. I remember playing sitting in a dugout, doing like an alumni game after he had. This might have been like in 2001, the year after he signed. I'm coming back to playing it in January, and watching him hit one of the games. I was sitting with our coach Gary Adams. God, look at that finish. It's just so pretty. grinder. Was all for some reason there was always a stigma of him defensively. But I think what happened with that is when he came into UCLA, he was a shortstop. He should have never played shortstop. He just didn't have enough arm for it. Mm-hmm. And then when he flipped over to second base, it was fine. I mean, I played behind him in Scranton and AAA when he had him, also watching him as a freshman playing center field at UCLA. He got the job done. He didn't make it. Once he went to second base, he was fine. So I think a lot what does is scouts say, oh, that saw him or had him in as a shortstop before, oh, he can't play defense or this and that. But even when he was in Scranton and stuff like that, he always made the plays. He grinded. He got to everything. Maybe didn't look the prettiest, but the play was made. And then as his career went on, he was definitely a plus second baseman, that's for sure. But great player, instinctual, gamer, one of the fiercest competitors probably ever played the game of baseball. He was a second round pick by the Dodgers out of high school, and he was at one point.
How did they not sign him?
So he agreed. I mean, because at that time they wouldn't have taken him if they didn't think they were. So I think he had a deal for $500,000. So at that time, Troy Gloss was at UCLA still, and he had turned down. He was drafted in the second round by the Padres too out of high school, and chose not to sign and go to UCLA. So I believe Chase had agreed, and he was going on a senior trip. Then when he came back, he might even, Dave and his dad or whatever, might have even talked to Troy's mom and kind of just talking about everything. And he ended up not signing and coming to UCLA. And luckily for the Phillies, we got him in 2000.
Yeah. And the Phillies, I remember the day they drafted him. And you'll know this. Mike Lieberthal's dad was a great area scout. For the Detroit Tigers. Uh-huh. And I had his phone number. And so they drafted this kid, Chase Utley, frankly, I had not heard of. And I'm sitting in the press box at Veterans Stadium. And the draft started in the daytime then. So a reporter, you use your contacts.
Yeah.
So I ring up Dennis Lieberthal, who I know is a scout for the Detroit Tigers.
Yeah.
And I said, have you seen Chase Utley? He said, I've seen him as many times as there are stars in the sky.
Yeah.
And I said, what's he like? He says, the Phillies just got a great player. I mean, he just absolutely so loved that pick.
Yeah. I remember Marty, he was a scouting, Marty Wolliver was our scouting director at the time. And, oh no, excuse me, he wasn't. Mike Arbuckle was. So it was like the big knock was, oh, where is he going to play? Or he can't play this and that. And it's like, he can swing the bat and he's going to hit. So when you have that type of talent, they'll find a place to play for you. But that just goes back to the mark where, for me, I never saw that as him being a bad defender, because I think that was more or less it went with him as far as because he didn't really look good at shortstop, and it kind of carried it with him maybe in other scouts' eyes.
Tell me what it's like when all the Philly scouting staff, it's a large group of guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been out on the road since the college season starts on February 22nd, I think. And they, you guys are working out guys in gymnasiums and indoor facilities all winter long. Tell me what it's like as you guys convene at Citizens Bank Park, and now you're in the war room, and all the reports and the computers and the whiteboard. And are you guys in there arguing about players? What's the give and take like as you're trying to zero in on who you're going to take number one, if eighth overall?
Yeah.
Who you're going to take in the second round? You know, what's the exchange of ideas like?
Yeah, definitely. There could be professional arguments at times. It's definitely not like, I'm right and you're wrong type of thing. Because, the biggest thing is you want every scout in there to feel comfortable and to give their point of view. Because in the end, I want to be able to, hey, this is what I think on a so-and-so player. And then I want another scout in the room to say what he says and to make me say he doesn't like him as much and maybe some of the things that I never thought about, or weighed into my analysis of the player. So you definitely want as many opinions that you can have, and then that helps formulate kind of what we think the player is, what's maybe a floor and a ceiling with them, and just to even challenge your conviction on a guy for the most part. But yeah, it's definitely professional.
Is there adrenaline in that room on draft night?
I think because especially if you want a certain player to get there. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a lot. Last year when you're picking one, we started it off, but yeah, this year eight. Say we have a guy that we're really zoning in on where we're saying a certain number of guys we know aren't going to be there for our pick, but say there's a guy that we like and maybe it's kind of up in the air. Yeah, there's definitely kind of that suspense a little bit.
Did you mentioned number one last year, Mickey Moniak, playing at Lakewood. Did you, as a Southeast guy, did you peek in on him as well?
Yeah, I saw Mickey play in the summer, and then I went and actually saw him in the spring. So, yeah, great-looking hitter. He should be a good one for us, and it's just a matter of going up the steps to the minor leagues and doing what he's got to do at each level, keep getting stronger and learning what it takes to be a pro.
Well, the Phillies, they're in a rebuild and they're committed to building through I guess you'd call it player procurement. You have to draft well. You have to have good international signings. Mm-hmm. You have to bring good players into your organization, and a lot of them, to get a handful to the big leagues, and then it becomes kind of a self-sustaining thing if that happens. And you guys, I have great respect for what you guys do, major cog in what they're trying to do, riding around the country, flying around the country, away from your families, and it all comes to a head in a few nights here. And I wish you a lot of luck, Eric.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Eric Valente as much as I did. I'm Jim Salisbury, and we'll catch you next time at the Yard.
It's called PAD, peripheral arterial disease, and if you've got chronic leg pain, it may be time to get tested. Learn more at demanddebora.org. Call 609-621-2080 to schedule a screening.